okay, we're going to go back to radiation and stick with this for a couple more minutes. Let's do a quick and dirty outrage assessment on two different radiation hazards. We'll do geological radon. You know, we talked about yesterday, so most of we know a little bit about that. And we'll simultaneously do EMFs. EMFs from power transmission lines or cell phone towers, whichever you prefer. They're very similar, so we'll talk about them at the same time. Now, we're going to make some simplifying assumptions. We're going to assume that these 12 variables are dichotomous, which, of course, they're not. You know, you can be, you know, it's not like being pregnant. You can be a little bit memorable. But we're going to assume they're dichotomous. We're going to assume these 12 are the only ones there are, and that's not true either. There are longer lists. And we're going to assume they're equally important, and that's not true. Some of them are bigger or normally bigger than others. But making those three simplifying assumptions, let's do a quick outrage assessment of EMFs and radon, two different radiological risks. Are you with me? We're going to do it together. All right, voluntary versus coerced. Is my exposure to EMFs from transmission lines voluntary or coerced? Or I'll allow you, instead of quite dichotomous, I'll allow you three options. Voluntary or coerced or in the middle, you know, doesn't count. Okay, so EMFs, voluntary or coerced? Coerced. How about radon? I think in the middle. You know, there's nobody, you know, building radon, you know, forcing me to endure radon. But it's, you know, I'm certainly not volunteering for it either. So we're 1-0. Are you with me? Natural versus industrial. EMFs, natural or industrial? Radon?
Natural.
Natural. So +1 for EMFs, -1 for radon. Okay. That's not true, of course, of all radon. Phosphate mining also produces waste piles that emit radon, and it's a very hot issue. In places where there are phosphate mine chip piles, those piles are, you know, the radon from those piles are considered industrial pollution and produce very high levels of outrage. But when it's not industry's radon, it's not the mining industry's radon, it's God's radon, it produces a hell of a lot less outrage. Familiar versus exotic. Okay. EMFs, familiar risk or exotic risk? Maybe in the middle. You know, I mean, you know, we're all used to transmission lines. How about radon? Also, I think in the middle. It's weird. I mean, the familiarity is very strange. I remember working at Hanford, which is a nuclear waste site from bomb building. And I was working with a bunch of rad waste employees who are extremely accustomed to radiation and were absolutely freaking out about the barrels of radioactive chemicals they were dealing with, not because they were radioactive, but because they were chemicals. It was really fun. They had absolutely no fear of radiation, but they were terrified of hydrocarbons. It's all what's familiar. All right, memorable versus not memorable. EMFs. You know, you got a big transmission line in your backyard looking at you. Memorable, yeah. See, I mean that tower. Every time you look at that tower, you think about the fact that it's bombarding you with electromagnetic waves. That tower is a major source of memorability. What about radon? No, nothing to look at, nothing to see. I can tell you don't believe me about the tower.
Well, I'm just thinking of more, I guess, along the lines of communication. If something was like in front of your face all day long, you get used to it being in your environment, and oftentimes you gloss over it.
Fair enough. I mean, after a while, my grandmother lived near the elevated railway in New York City, and when they tore it down, she couldn't sleep because at specified times she woke up with the sound of the railroad, the train not passing. You get used to it.
New transmission line would be very memorable.
Yes.
If you lived next to one your entire life, that's not be out of the ordinary. You'd be like a tree.
I think that's fair. So, you know, a transmission line that's salient to you because it's new, lots of memorability, a transmission line you grew up with, you know, we have a transmission line I never noticed. Okay. I'll buy that. How about dread? How much dread do people feel about EMFs? What do you think? Well, yeah, but we're assuming it's in your backyard. It's radiation. It's cancer. I think dread's going to be pretty high for both of them, but in both cases it's radiation and it's cancer. You get a fair amount of dread out of that in most people. Three Mile Island, for example. The odds are very good that, as I said yesterday, that Three Mile Island actually improved health. Factory shut down for a week, but it's the outrage about radiation was certainly enormously higher than the outrage about routine industrial emissions.
That's very obsessed on the outrage of the after the fact. You wouldn't be outraged about it until there's cancer.
Oh, I'm not sure that's true. No, if somebody says a cancer-causing substances, or a cancer-causing, in the case of radiation, a cancer-causing process. Is in your backyard and it's constantly irradiating you with cancer-causing rays, and you and your children are gonna have a much higher risk of cancer in the years ahead. I think people experience the dread right away. If I were doing anti-EMF communication, I would certainly focus a fair amount on dread. And those of you who remember the radon ads of the 1980s and the early 1990s, they absolutely played up dread of radiation. They had strobe lights and all kinds of eerie radiation music. I helped produce those ads. By the way, when you talk about radiation, I've been doing this kind of training, but typically when you talk about radiation, a large percentage of the males in the audience cross their legs. I can't see what's going on. That's why they put skirts on the tables. I can't see what you're doing down there, but I suspect there are a lot of legs crossed when we start talking about radiation and how it's going to get you. Chronic versus catastrophic. These are both chronic, or at least they're in the middle. You may experience it as a catastrophe when you first find out about it. Again, the point of a new cell tower or a new transmission line, or newly discovered radon, there may be that may be experienced as catastrophic rather than chronic. But I'd be hard pressed to give them credit for that. How about no ability? No ability is partly detectability. It's partly expert disagreement, uncertainty. Those things all cause more outrage, particularly expert disagreement. So what's the level of expert disagreement about the health effects of EMFs? Very high. You got some experts saying it's good for you, and some experts saying it's bad for you. Very high expert disagreement. Radon. No expert disagreement there, or very little. Almost all the experts have agreed that radon is reasonably serious. Radon is a hazard, but EMFs are a controversy, and controversy is going to generate a lot of outrage. Controlled by me versus controlled by others. Who controls my exposure to EMFs? Other people, they're building something in my backyard. I can't really tell them not to. Who controls my exposure to radon? I do. Okay, I can test it. If I have a high level, I can remediate. It's much more feeling of agency, much more sense of being able to control your own risk. Fair versus unfair. A lot of things go into fairness, but the main one is the distribution of hazard compared to the distribution of benefit. If If I'm taking the risk, I want to get the benefit. If you're taking the risk, and if I'm taking the risk and you're getting the benefit, then there's going to be a lot of outrage because that's an unfair risk. Does that make sense to everybody? The unfair risk is a high outrage risk, and therefore people tend to overestimate the hazard. A fair risk is a low outrage risk, and therefore people tend to underestimate the hazard. EMFs, fair or unfair? Unfair, right? I mean, you know, the bastards are putting a transmission line through my backyard in order to give somebody else power. How about radar? Neither one, you know. I mean, it's again God's fault, and it's hard to be mad at God for treating you unfairly. But it's, you know, it's certainly not the same thing as if you got the benefits. This is, by the way, why cell towers routinely generate enormously more controversy than cell phones. The hazard, the evidence is that neither hazard is very high, but the phone hazard is considerably higher than the tower hazard. Because you don't put the tower right up against your head. If there's a phone risk, it's probably brain cancer. There's mixed evidence about brain cancer. See, get off your phone. But it's very hard to get people in outrage about cell phone risk because they love their cell phone. It's very easy to get people outraged about the risk of the tower because they don't love the tower in the backyard. Okay? That's unfair. That tower is serving other people. Morally relevant versus morally irrelevant. Okay. Is it just a risk, or is it just dangerous, or is it also evil? What would you say about EMFs? Evil, yeah. It's a big industry, you know, trying to build their profits by putting up more power. What about radon? Just the risk. It's not, you know, as though it's not morally relevant. Sources are trusted or not trusted. You know, who are the people that tell you not to worry about EMFs? The power company says, don't worry about it. Can we trust those bastards? What about the sources with regard to radon risk? More so. Much less of an issue of trust. And finally, responsive. Are they listening? Are they responding? Much higher levels of outrage on responsiveness with regard to EMFs than with regard to radon. Now, we could do this much more carefully if we had time, but all I'm trying to do is illustrate for you, how to do it. You can do it as casually as we've just done it and get something that's enormously more useful than nothing at all. In 30 years of doing this work, it's rare for me to encounter a client who has assessed the outrage wrong. It's common for me to encounter a client who hasn't assessed the outrage at all. So I'm much less committed to you doing it well than to you doing it. And if you do it, however sloppy, even as sloppy as we just did, is enough to say EMFs are going to be pretty high outrage and radon is going to be pretty low outrage. It doesn't take much more than the 5 minutes we just gave it to reach a conclusion. Okay. Based on what we've said so far, let me outline for you the kinds of risk communication. What we're going to do is graph hazard against outrage. And I want to start down here. The lower right-hand corner, the high hazard, low outrage risks. This is the venue of what I call precaution advocacy. The paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out. This could kill you. Do something. Wear a condom. Wear a hard hat. Wear a seatbelt. Not necessarily all at the same time. And in ways that I hope are obvious, given what we've said so far this morning, the essence of precaution advocacy is to try to increase the outrage. You're trying to increase the outrage in order to increase the hazard perception. in order to increase people's willingness to take precautions or demand precautions. Questions about that? So let's look very quickly at some of the technical specifications for doing good precaution advocacy. And I'm going to go through more when we get to precaution advocacy in particular, but let's look at three now. And the first of the three that I want to mention is keep your message short. Why do you keep your message short, particularly in precaution advocacy? Well, yeah, but that's true for all messaging. Why, particularly in precaution advocacy, is brevity essential? That's right. People are apathetic. People aren't interested. You're trying to arouse apathetic people. You know, low outrage and apathy are synonyms. And when you're dealing with apathetic people, you know, their attention span is very short. You're going to have to keep your message very short. The second tech spec for precaution advocacy that I want to mention is make it interesting. That's also grounded in the reality of apathy. You know, apathetic people, you're trying to ensnare their interest. I do a lot of work with corporate safety, and one of the hard-won lessons in corporate safety communication over the last 20 years, and this I think applies to a lot of health communication as well, is making your message interesting is important enough that even irrelevant content is worth its weight if it arouses interest. So if you've ever gone to company safety meetings, and there's nothing quite as stultifying as a half-hour mandatory corporate safety meeting, and they have learned at those meetings that if they tell jokes and have riddles and door prizes and sing songs, do all kinds of stuff that is vanishingly irrelevant, but it keeps people awake. And if you can keep people awake, maybe you can expand your message from, an 8-second soundbite to 25 or 30 seconds. You cover three or four times as much content. So making your message interesting, even if you have to make it interesting irrelevantly, becomes worth doing in precaution advocacy. And the third and the last one I'm going to mention in this broad introduction is stay on message. In precaution advocacy, you figure out what your core messages are, you test them, you wordsmith them, and once you've got them, you stick to them, come follow my word. And, this should be obvious, but this is a room full of communicators. Do these principles sound familiar? Keep it short, make it interesting, stay on message. Those are PR 101. It's not a surprise that the tech specs for precaution advocacy are the same as the tech specs for public relations, because they're grounded in the same assumption of an audience that is much less interested in your topic than you are. And your primary job is to grab their attention away from whatever else they're wanting to pay attention to and get them to pay attention to you. So PR and precaution advocacy are kissing cousins. Okay, in stark contrast to precaution advocacy, in the opposite corner, we have the high outrage, low hazard risks. This is the venue of what I call outrage management. And the key task here is to reduce the outrage. And again, you're not trying to reduce the outrage for the fun of it. You're trying to reduce the outrage in order to reduce the hazard perception, in order to reduce people's inclination to take precautions or to demand that you take precautions that you think are foolish and unnecessary. So if the paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out, the paradigm in outrage management is calm. But the message isn't calm down. Why not? What happens when you tell people to calm down? They get more outraged, right? Especially if you say, calm down, you hysterical fool. Which is normally what your tone of voice says on those moments when you're telling people to calm down. There have been health directors, that's right, don't panic. Or even worse, it's too soon to panic. you know, so calm down is not the message, okay? But calm down is the paradigm. What you're trying to do is to get them more apathetic rather than less apathetic. You're trying to reduce outrage with regard to a risk that you think is not so serious. Now, in precaution advocacy, well, as I've said, the key to precaution advocacy is increasing the outrage. It's very hard for people in health departments to wrap their minds around. I've had endless health department clients that have said to me over the years, we want to get people to take precautions, but we don't want to frighten them. Okay? Which is a little bit like saying, you know, I want to write a novel, but I don't want to use the letter E. It's not impossible. It has, in fact, been done. But it's a hell of a handicap. In outrage management, on the other hand, you've got exactly the opposite problem. Instead of the worry about whether it's okay to frighten them, you're worrying about whether it's okay to reassure them. And in general, health departments are an easier time wrapping their mind out of calming people down than out of riling people up, which is interesting because you spend most of your time, of course, trying to increase outrage. It's only on rare occasions that you're trying to decrease outrage. But increasing outrage, you know, is awkward if, you know, because you really don't want to scare people. Decreasing outrage, you know, maybe feels a little bit better to you. Now let's look at the three textbooks for precaution advocacy and see if they work in outrage management. The first textbook we mentioned for precaution advocacy was keep it short. Do you have to keep your message short in outrage management? Do you? You come to a meeting and stay till midnight. Instead of a 10-second soundbite, you have a 10-hour meeting. And then next week, another 10-hour meeting. We think about those meetings about pesticide spraying for West Nile virus. They went on all night. Highly outraged people, no need to keep your message short.
Question.
Yes?
How does that square with the idea that when people are upset, they're not hearing things the same way?
It doesn't square with it. Two things are going on. It's Vincent Cavello who says, and he's right, that when people are upset, their ability to process information declines. It is also true that when people are upset, their motivation to process information increases. So both things are true. You become a worse information processor and a more dedicated information processor. Just think about your use of the internet the week after you've been diagnosed with cancer. You know, you may be having trouble mastering all that shit, but you sure are spending lots of hours trying. Okay? So the trick is to simplify every sentence, but not to shorten and simplify your message, because outraged people have lots of willingness. It's only their ability that's been damaged. That makes sense.
Doesn't it also, help, show empathy too, by taking the time and willing to answer the issue as opposed to just trying to be so brief?
It may. It depends. If you're droning on and on and on and on lecturing, I think it probably doesn't show empathy. If you're being responsive, it's certainly going to show empathy. But showing empathy is enormously important in outrage management, but I would separate it from the length of your message. Because I think that's a 2x2 table. It's possible to be short and empathic, long and empathic, short and arrogant, long and arrogant. And I've certainly encountered a lot of long and arrogant. I've been accused of doing it. So I don't want to necessarily equate those two. But keeping your message short doesn't matter. How about making your message interesting? You have to make it interesting in outrage management? No, they're already interested. They are, in fact, obsessed. And your job is to make it boring. Now, that doesn't mean you can afford to give a boring speech. What happens if you give a boring speech? Do outraged people get bored if you give a boring speech?
No.
What do they get? They get madder. You know, how dare you waste my time with this boring speech? So you can't afford to give a boring speech. You can't come into a room full of outraged people with 120 PowerPoint slides, you know, full of data. You will exacerbate their outrage. So just as you can't say calm down, you can't be boring, but it is your job at some point in time for them to get bored with the issue. You know, at some point in time, you want them to say to themselves, well, there's another meeting tonight. Should I go, or should I stay home and watch reruns on TV? I think I'll stay home and watch reruns on TV. It sounds more interesting. You know, and you know, when they're not coming to the meeting because the meeting is, the issues are boring, then you know, you're well on your way toward getting the issue under control. When they're not coming to the meeting because you are, you know, arrogant and long-winded and unresponsive, that's not, that, then you haven't achieved anything. Okay, and finally, the third was stay on message. I argued that in precaution advocacy, you know, you're essentially doing a monologue. You don't really care what they have to say back. They haven't got anything much to say back. It's enough, barely enough if you get them to listen. That, I mean, if people in precaution advocacy, if your audience suddenly wants to say something, for God's sake, shut up and listen. But that's rare. In precaution advocacy, your audience rarely has much to say. What about outrage management? Should you walk into outrage management with your messages pre-designed? Shut up and listen. Why do outraged people come to a public meeting? What is their goal?
They want to be heard.
They want to be heard. Yeah. Or, as we sometimes say, they want to vent. Now, they have their own tech specs. They don't want to vent in a closet. They want to vent in front of you, in front of each other, and in front of journalists. Okay. And nothing much useful will happen until they have had an opportunity to vent. Oftentimes, my clients in outrage management will say to me, how do we keep them from venting? And there are ways to keep them from venting. The science fair design is the most common way. You know, you know, it's divide and conquer. You have 19 tables or even 19 rooms, and everybody interested in this aspect go there, everybody interested in that aspect go there, and we defend that on the grounds that everybody gets to have a one-on-one conversation. But we all know that our real goal is nobody gets to have an audience. You know, and it's not like that doesn't work. That does work. The question is the goal like? Is it useful to stop people from venting? And I would argue that when people are outraged, nothing useful happens until they have had a chance to vent. So they come to vent, and you come to listen to them vent. And it's active listening. You don't read a novel. You actually listen. You take notes. You nod your head every 17 seconds. You murmur every 22 seconds. For God's sake, don't write down those numbers. I just made them up. But you do nod your head and take notes and murmur, and in a variety of other ways communicate that you are listening. And very interesting things happen when you are listening to outraged people vent. What happens to their outrage? Lessons. That doesn't go down to zero because the whatever is causing the outrage hasn't been meaningfully diminished yet. They're venting it, and they have a lot stored up. So as they vent it, you know, there's less stored up, and they get calmer. And as they get calmer, a very interesting thing starts to happen. They start to want to listen to you. They start out wanting to listen to you. They start out wanting to vent at you. But, you know, as you are listening, they begin to wonder what your response to everything they've been saying is. And eventually they get in your face and say, well, what have you got to say for yourself? You've been sitting there like a bump on a log for 4 hours. You've been taking notes. You've been murmuring, what have you got to say? Now, the first time they do that, the right thing to do is demur. Oh, it's premature. There are people who haven't spoken yet. I'm learning so much this evening. Try not to let that sound sarcastic. and eventually the entire room unites behind the principle that it's your turn. And that's a watershed in the meeting. You know, when people start shushing each other up in order to listen to you, something important has happened. And when people are outraged, I say to my clients, don't talk until that happens. I mean, except for, you know, the refreshments are in the back and, you know, please sign in and, you know, logistical things. But don't talk substantively until the group wants you to, begs you to, demands that you talk. Is it clear, and we're going to come back to both of these two kinds of risk mitigation, but is it clear that precaution advocacy and outrage management are very different?
Yeah.
Now, you can be good at both. You know, I mean, you can be a good carpenter and a good electrician. But you better know the difference. If you start hammering nails into circuits, you're probably going to make things worse. And similarly, if you use outrage management strategies in a precaution advocacy environment, or you use precaution advocacy strategies in an outrage management environment, you're going to make things worse. These have very little in common. And then, you know, you need to diagnose which environment you're in before you can figure out which toolkit you need. Now, I hope it's obvious, but let me just emphasize, you know, in case it's not obvious, you know, you may assess the situation differently than somebody else. So you may be doing precaution advocacy on an issue that somebody else is doing outrage management on. You know, right now, if you're very preoccupied with H1N1 and you're trying to persuade people to get vaccinated, you're doing precaution advocacy on the flu and outrage management on the vaccine.
Right.
Everybody agree? Okay. There are people out there doing outrage management on the flu and precaution advocacy on the vaccine. They disagree with you. And because their assessment of the situation is different, whether it's different because of ideology, or it's different because of employment, or it's different because of assessment of the data, I'll leave that to your judgment. You know, but for a variety of reasons, you wound up on one side and somebody else wound up on the other side, and you are both doing the right thing according to your lights. Yes? Precaution advocacy and outrage management at the same time with different groups of people.
And possibly online. I mean, it's a process over time. It's not an event.
Yes, it's harder that way. No question about it. You know, online actually is not so hard. It is not too difficult to have filter questions on your website, so that people who are very upset and need to be calmed down wind up in a different corner of the website than people who are apathetic and you know, barely interested enough to get to your site, but need to be, you know, made more interested and provided with precaution advocacy kinds of messages. You can do that. Now, obviously, they have to have the same base of information. They have to be compatible enough with each other that if somebody goes and reads what you wrote for the other side, it's not embarrassing. But on a well-designed website filters people into the messaging that's aimed at them. PSA is much harder. You know, PSA, you're going to have to split the difference. You're going to have to decide which audience you care about. Judgment.
I always get asked the question about how do you do outrage management when you're talking to a large audience through the media, and it really is one way. And the answer to me connects a lot with one of the AED speech yesterday. You tell people stories about themselves. You talk about the outraged people who have contacted your office so that the people listening feel that you know about them. So you're representing them in your messages to them. My neighbor tells me she's worried about the vaccine. Even my own sister says X or Y. So you represent the different outraged target audiences as you talk to them through the media, even though it's unidirectional speech.
That sounds good, but how do we know when in a mass media situation they've reached this point in a meeting that they want to listen?
You need to do overnights. That's when you need Blendon's work. This map is a moving target. I mean, think people change, people, you know, the situation changes. You don't just figure out once where you are on the map. You keep re-asking where you are on the map. And, you know, my bias is in favor of asking the questions correctly. Because my experience is, even if you guess at the answer, you're going to do a whole lot better than if you haven't asked the question. So, you know, if you can't afford to hire Blendon, you know, back up and, you know, ask a few people on your way home. You know, there's a name in research methodology for asking a few people on your way home. It's called a purposive sample. That is to say, you haven't got a random sample, but you're trying to approximate that, you know, in a casual way without a lot of budget. And that's better than nothing. If you can't even ask anybody what's going on, you can still sit at your desk and wonder, you know, has the situation changed? What's the story now? And as I said earlier in a slightly different context, my clients do this wrong far more often because they didn't ask the question than because they asked the question and got the wrong answer. But it's absolutely true that the answer changes. As it has changed, and will continue to change with regard to H1N1, as all it takes a whole bunch, a handful of people dying of the disease in a particular community, and suddenly that community is much more worried about the disease and much less worried about the vaccine, and you need a different PSA for them next week than you needed this week, and nimbleness is not something health departments are renowned for. But you do the best you can to keep up with the situation so that you're not responding, to last month's public opinion. I want to finish off this map. Up here, high hazard, high outrage is our third paradigm. People are upset, and they are right to be upset because they are, in fact, endangered. And this is crisis communication. And I'm not going to draw any arrow. Okay. In outrage management, your problem is people are excessively upset. You're trying to calm them down. In precaution advocacy, your problem is people are insufficiently upset. You're trying to get them more upset, increase the outrage. In crisis communication, they got it right. They are appropriately upset. And it's unnecessary to get them more upset, and it's unethical to get them less upset and inappropriate. You need their outrage to motivate them to take precautions. So there's no change in outrage necessary, but there's still a lot of communicating necessary. Because in a crisis, people are appropriately upset, but they need help bearing it. And they need help figuring out what to do about it, taking wise precautions rather than unwise precautions. Their outrage is motivating them to take precautions, but not necessarily the right one. So if the paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out, the paradigm in outrage management is calm down, the paradigm in crisis communication is we'll get through this together. The cardinal sin in crisis communication is telling people not to be upset. They are right to be upset. You're trying to help them bear how upset they are, and when you tell them not to be upset, you are helping making it harder to bear rather than easier to bear. We'll say more about that this afternoon when we get to crisis communication. Down here, low hazard, low outrage. I'm not going to draw a circle. I have not found that to be a profit opportunity. I earn my living in the other three corners, but if people are apathetic about something that isn't very serious, there's not much to be said to them. What would you say? Congratulations on your apathy. You're absolutely right. This is true. Trying to get appropriately apathetic people aroused is a foolish use of your energy. Now, it all depends. I mean, there's a time element here. If they are down in this lower left-hand corner temporarily, and you anticipate that they are soon going to be outraged, you may need to do some proactive preventive outrage management. If you anticipate that pretty soon the hazard's going to get higher, you may want to do some proactive, preemptive caution advocacy. If you anticipate that both are going to get higher, you want to do something called pre-crisis communication. You know, telling them about the crisis that's coming. They're not upset yet, but they're about to be, and it's about to be serious. So I'm by no means saying that if you're in the lower left-hand corner, you never have any communicating to do. If you're permanently in the lower left-hand corner, you don't have any communicating to do. If you're temporarily in that corner, then you can get a head start on where you think you're going to be soon. And finally, right in the middle, we have the sweet spot. People are upset enough that they're paying attention, but not so upset that they're freaking out. The hazard is serious enough that you have things to say to them, but not so serious that you have that time to say it because you need to evacuate them or inoculate them or whatever. And lots of very good risk communication happens in the sweet spot. The sweet spot, unlike the lower left-hand corner, the sweet spot is a really important kind of risk communication, but it's easy. People are listening, they're respectful. If they don't understand, they ask follow-up questions. What happens? It's interesting to ask the question, what happens when you say something people don't understand? In precaution advocacy, if you say something people don't understand, they tune out. In outrage management, if you say something people don't understand, they assume it's a conspiracy and get more outraged. In crisis communication, if you say something people don't understand, they die. In the sweet spot, if you say something people don't understand, they ask you to explain it better. Okay, so the sweet spot is a natural, organic, easy dialogue. It's important for you to do, but it's important not to get stuck there because the hard work happens in the three corners. So if you're a vaccination person, you could be doing precaution advocacy with people who are not getting their appropriate shots because they're apathetic about the infectious diseases. You could be doing outrage management about the MMR and autism and thimerosal. You could be doing crisis communication about, or preparing to do crisis communication in the event that H1N1 takes a turn for the worse and you wind up having to inoculate millions of people as quickly as you possibly can. Or you could be, hanging out in the sweet spot, chatting with vaccine fans. And there are vaccine fans, and they call you, when they want to chat about the latest MMWR, and you don't really want to get caught in doing too much of that to the exclusion of the three difficult corners. But what's most important is the three difficult corners are difficult in entirely different ways. So you need to ask yourself, where am I on the map? What that translates to is how high do I think the hazard is, how high do I think the outrage is, how high do I think the hazard and outrage are going to be soon. And based on your answers to those four questions, you know where you are on the map. And based on where you are on the map, you know which toolkit you need. Now, it's time to take the break. I should warn you that I'm not done with the introduction. I have yet to explain the three risk mitigation games, which are critically important to explain. So if you can manage to keep the break to 10 minutes, I would be grateful. If you take your full 15, I won't be shocked. But somewhere between 10 minutes and 15 minutes from now, we'll come back together.